Now, what on earth is a church? Who needs it? What is it here for? What on earth could it all be about? It'd be easy enough to mistake a church for a society for the preservation of old buildings. It is often credited as being a powerful institution with political muscle and great money and influence. To some people, the church is of great importance. Without its worship, without its sacraments, without its priests, there would be no salvation for men. Within these hallowed walls, during particularly hallowed moments, following certain hallowed rites, God pops out for the appearance of sceptical people, or credulous people, as you may like to think of it. Some people think that to the running of a church is of enormous significance, and without a building, God may get very cold. Of course, to other people, the church is a complete irrelevance. It's archaic, if not anachronistic, to continue such an organisation. It says nothing, does nothing, and is nothing. A gathering of old ladies, specially designed to keep them off the streets, or the croquet courts, or the bowling greens. Yet there are others for whom the church is neither important nor irrelevant. It can't be irrelevant because they're Christians, and the church is a Christian church, and therefore should have something to do with them somewhere along the line. But it's not very important because their Christianity is a personal relationship with God, found through Jesus Christ, found in the Scriptures, found quite independently of any church anywhere. And seemingly the church has just been imposed upon them as a little extra activity that you need to get engaged in on Sunday, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. Now, what all this has to do with my milkman, you will see in present time. But in the meantime, I wish to draw your attention to the prayer of Paul in the Epistle to the Ephesians. And we'll work through it phrase by phrase, really, this week. It occurs in those verses 15 to 23 that Colin read for us. And in it, you will start to understand, I hope, the importance of the church, because the way in which Paul speaks about the church here is quite surprising to most of our ears. Indeed, we could write this whole passage, this prayer, and drop out the word church, and I'm not sure we'd notice the difference. But clearly, Paul would have. The basis of the prayer is the faith in the Lord Jesus and the love for all the saints that he's heard the Ephesians, or whoever to whomever he is writing, have. He doesn't know of them in first hand, it would seem, but he has heard that they believe in Jesus, that they are Christians, and that as Christians they are living with love for all the saints. That is not to the men in stained glass windows with saucers behind their heads, but rather to the Lord's people. They are displaying that love, which is characteristic of Christian people, that they love one another. And therefore, he gives thanks for them. Indeed, he has not stopped giving thanks for them. As we do also need to be giving thanks for the news of people who are Christians, so Paul does. But he not only gives thanks, he also prays for them. In verses 17 and 18, there is a twofold prayer, a twofold request for them, that they might have a spirit of wisdom and revelation, and that they might be enlightened, that their hearts may be enlightened. The spirit of wisdom and of revelation is to lead them to a clearer knowledge of God, a personal, relational knowledge, to know God and to know him better. Very hard to know someone whom you have got no knowledge, of whom you have no knowledge. Very hard to know somebody who doesn't reveal himself to you. I can look around tonight and see some faces of people whom I have, as far as I can recall anyway, never met. I'm glad that you're here. I'm sorry I haven't had the opportunity of meeting you before. I'm even sorrier if I think I haven't met you and I have. That does happen. As you sit there, strange face as you may be, not that it's particularly strange, but strange to me, as you sit there with your strange face, I can say to myself, I don't know that person. I can see by the sullen look that they have very little sense of humour. Or I can see by the quick smile that their humour is easily teased by the meanest of wit. So that there are certain things that you can be telling me about yourself. Just some things you can be telling about myself. But at the end of this sermon, you will know me better than I will know you. I hardly know you. Mind you, if the roles were reversed and you were preaching and I was sitting listening at the end of it, then I would know you. But for us to know each other, we have to reveal ourselves to each other. To know God requires God to reveal himself. To know him better requires even more revelation of God and a spirit of wisdom by which we can understand that revelation. And so Paul prays that we might have a spirit of wisdom and a revelation that we might know God and indeed know him better. He also prays that the hearts, our hearts, or the hearts of the people to whom he is writing, may be enlightened, that their eyes of their hearts may be enlightened. That's a very interesting anatomical structure, isn't it? You don't normally think of hearts having eyes or eyes having hearts. The heart, to them, is symbolically used of the mind, of the conscience, of the will, of the person, not of the seat of romance or emotions. That their minds, that their persons, that their wills may be opened to understand, to perceive with three consequences, or three aspects of the thing he would like them to understand, three ways in which he would like them enlightened. About the hope, the riches, and the power. I pray also that the eyes of your hearts may be enlightened in order that you may know the hope to which he has called you. There is the first one, the first aspect. The riches of his glorious inheritance in the saints. There is the second. And his incomparably great power for us who believe. There is the third. The three aspects of what he would like us to understand as a result of having our minds opened up by God. The hope to which he has called you is that which lies in front of you. The expectation that is laid up by God in heaven for you. If you are a Christian, then you have been called to live in heaven. You have been called to come home to the homeland of God's people where God dwells with all his people forever. That is the hope that lies before you. That is the hope to which, if you are a Christian, and because they believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, they clearly are that, because they have love for all the saints, they are clearly living as Christians, then the hope to which they have been called is the eternal riches of being with God's people forever. And so the second aspect is really the same as the first. The great riches of the glory of God, the riches of his inheritance which you share in the saints. That is what he is praying that they might understand. Just how well off we are going to be. That we might have our hearts and minds set. That we might really understand the tremendous wealth of living with God's people in his kingdom forever. It's his inheritance, you'll notice, because it comes from him, and because part of it is to have his own people gathered around about him. And that is why it is his inheritance in the saints. It is the fact that in the company of all God's people, we will all share in the glory of God, and we will be giving glory to God as God gives glory back to us. It'll be a marvelous scene of splendor. And Paul hopes that we may appreciate, that we might understand that our our minds might be open to take in just how incredibly splendid the whole situation will be. And more, thirdly, he prays that we might appreciate the power at work in us who believe. Of course, you look around here at the moment and it's not so splendid. In fact, not so crash hot. We have all due respects to you, I'm sure, but you can check around too. Who are we, a motley mob of Australians sitting down in an old building designed by someone who had an English idea of a cold winter and all the rest of it? We're sitting around with our hair in different shapes and shades, beards, beardlesses, and all kinds of other stages between. Some going bald, some all kinds of just people, aren't we? And we don't look wealthy, and we don't look mighty, and we don't look great. You wouldn't walk in this building and kind of cover your eyes for the splendid sight of the... You'd say it just looks like a mob I sit in the bus with on Tuesday mornings. Same kind of people, all sitting neatly in rows. Any tick of the clock, you expect someone to say, move right down the centre, please. Anyway, more polite than that, we just shove you down. Now, what's so special about this group of people? Here is a gathering of people. They look like any other gathering of people. Could be here for almost any old reason. But yet, what will be like in heaven is to be of splendour, greater than the greatest wealth and riches of any king and potentate that has ever lived. We will be transformed so that for each and every one of us will look like Christ. We'll be just like him in all his magnificence and beauty. It will be more than the eye can hold. But more than that, it's a miracle that you can raise us motley mob up to be anything that could universally be described as splendid. To transform us that much requires an incredible power. Why, I can't even change my habits, can you? How are you good at stopping one of those, you know, New Year's Eve, New Year's Day resolutions? How long do yours last? 2-3 days? 2-3 hours? 2-3 minutes? How long do yours last? You have terrible trouble changing the smallest thing about ourselves, don't we? But yet God says that he's actually going to transform us totally. That our lowly bodies will become like his glorious body. That is an incredible idea. That we as persons will be completely remade. Now the power at work in transforming people is the power that he wishes to talk about here, and is the power which he will talk about in the opening verses of next week. The power that has led people to be transformed by the gospel of Jesus for the last 2,000 years, that can transform your life, can transform the lives of your friends, and may already have transformed your life, if you're a Christian person. For you may already be feeling the touches of God in your life, as you become changed. This third thing that he wants us to understand is the power, the might, the strength that is at work in us. It is the same power, he says, that raised Jesus Christ from the dead. That power, the power of the resurrection, the power of the ascension, that not only raised him from the dead, but raised him to sit at the right hand of God in all power and might and authority. Like it says in Psalm 110, like it says in Psalm 8, where everything is laid out under his feet so that he becomes the ruler of the universe, the Lord, the master, the owner of everything that there is. He is the dominion, the king of all that happens. He is over and above everything, authority, dominion, title, rank, power. Anything that is anything in this world is under his authority, and in the world to come is under his authority. Crucial to realize the absolute unique status to which Jesus is said to have risen. Every second Saturday I say to Helen during the day, why me? Happens to me fortnightly on Saturdays actually. And it's because of my milkman. It's a terrible problem to me that I have to face every fortnight. Most people have milkmen who leave their milk bottles filled with milk on the doorstep, collect their money.
fact, most of the milkmen I've had, I've never met. Of course, I've just left the money out and the milk's appeared magic. There could be a cow coming around for all I know.
Wouldn't have the faintest how it gets there. It just appears. But not this milkman. He is different. He likes taking Saturday off. And so he doesn't deliver on Saturdays. Instead, he comes around personally during the middle of the day to collect your fortnightly bill. Never quite sure why he didn't take the whole Saturday off, but he doesn't. And he likes collecting the bill in person. He's not really interested in having it slipped to him. And he found out I was a clergyman. Which is why I want to say each time I meet him, why me? Why can't I have a normal milkman? For he starts every time with exactly the same phrase. Anything new in the church? It can't win on that line. I've been trying for some 14 months to win. I have yet to succeed on that line.
I said, oh, well, you know. He says, no, I wouldn't have thought so.
Sometimes Helen has rescued me and tried to take over for me, and she tells him, yes, great things are happening in the church. And he says, really? He then always proceeds to tell me of the latest book he's been reading, and he only reads religious books. Kind of science fiction type of religion. All about people's electric charges and healers and out-of-body experiences, and they frankly always strike me as semi-out-of-mind experiences as well. All kinds of different technological advances in the process of deeper spirituality. I get the lot of them, one after another. I cannot sign the check quickly enough, but it makes no difference. After having the check, he really is interested in sharing with me about the great glow that can come about healers. Yesterday, after 14 months, I had my first victory. It was a little victory, but it was my first victory. And do you know why I had it? Because I'd been preparing for tonight's sermon. Ephesians chapter 1 gave me my very first minor victory in 14 months. I don't like always telling about illustrations to my own praise and glory. And indeed, this one's not either. It's just a very important victory, and it illustrates the point. He said to me yesterday, have you heard about the charismatics? I thought, well, that's a switch. We're at least within the umbrella of Christianity this time. I said, oh, yeah, I've heard about charismatics. He said, friend across the road, he went to a charismatic meeting. I said, really? He said, yes, yes. He said, he had one leg 1.5 inches longer than the other leg. And he went to this charismatic ministry meeting, and they lengthened his leg. And now they're even. I didn't like to tell him that I've always thought that leg-pulling ministry was a little bit suspect. Just thought I'd let it drift along for that occasion. So he said, what do you make of that? And I said, well, you know. I never really had much to say. And he says, well, he says, these charismatic. He said, do you have charismatic churches? And I said, oh, yeah, they're all around here. He says, really? He said, all kinds of denominations? I said, yeah, all kinds of denominations. He says, can they all do the healing? And I said, oh, well, each of the churches, they might have some healing. They're individuals, not every member. And so we chatted on about this and that. He says, of course, the Russians, they've got it down to a T, you know. And I said, really? He said, yeah, they photograph people who are healers, and they've got an aura all around about them. I said, is that so? He said, yes, yes. And he said, they've been able now to create a machine in which they can get the aura from the healer into the machine. And then you don't need the healer. You've just got this machine, and you go to the machine, and the aura comes out of the machine, and you get healed. Every fortnight I get this, let me tell you. Every fortnight. You can see why I say, why me? There is almost no answer that is available to you under those circumstances, are there? I mean, the credulity involved is of such mammoth proportion that you may as well tell him that you saw Jesus in the bath last night. Let's try and share with him the news of the gospel. However, Ephesians 1 came to my mind. And I said, yes, well, those things can happen, don't they? And he said, oh, he says, there are lots of things happening. Lots of things happening outside the churches, inside the churches. I said, yeah, you're right. You're right. I said, there's all kinds of powers and principalities we really wouldn't know about, aren't there? He said, yes. I said, there's much more than just the material world and universe. There's
There's things everywhere, aren't there? He said, yes, that's what I've been telling you for a long time. He says, it really is everywhere. So I said, yeah, I agree with you, everywhere. And he said, yes, well, that's marvelous. And I said, of course, what I really believe most firmly is that Jesus is the Lord and Master of every one of them.
Oh, I said, well, it's a matter of kind of, yeah, it's generally true, I suppose, he said, and left.
I tell you, I'm now on the scent of something big.
I'm almost looking forward to a fortnight passing. That's because it's only one day gone.
But that is a great truth from this passage, you see, that the powers and principalities do exist, whatever they come in, whatever in form, and whether or not the Russians can lock them up in a box. The powers of the university do exist. Christians don't deny the supernatural. It's ridiculous to be denying that. That is not the case. What we're saying, though, is that Jesus is the Lord and Master of everyone. Doesn't matter what they are, where they are, who they are, how they operate, Jesus is above them all. For he has been raised up not only from death, but raised up to sit at the very right hand of God in all power and authority as the supreme Lord and Master of everything. For that is great, God's great plan, of which Timothy would have reminded you last week from chapter 1, verse 10, to sum up everything under the headship of Christ, to have Christ as the head of the whole universe is God's plan. And in raising Jesus from death, to sit him at the right hand of God, that is what is taking place. That the whole universe be placed under him. And in being placed under him, you notice the very last phrase in our chapter, everything is being filled by him. He is filling all things in all. He is now engaged in doing that. But what's it mean to say you fill everything? What's it mean to say he fills the whole universe? It's not a pantheistic idea, as if this is now him and that's him and everything around about us is him. But rather, his presence pervades everything in the universe. That is, when he was in an earthly body, when he was the man Jesus walking in Palestine, he was there in one place and one place only. He didn't fill the universe. He didn't fill Palestine. He stood on one little square foot of it, like you can stand on one square foot. For he was man, fully man, and he was just in one place at one time. But now that he has been raised from death, now that he has been raised out of the limitations of this world order, his position of power and authority is such that he can pervade the whole universe with his power. There is no place where he cannot reach. There is no kind or manner of existence outside his scope of dominion. Jesus is the Lord of Australia, of Austria, of Russia and China. There's nowhere you can go that is beyond him. Jesus is the Lord of men and women. He is the Lord of all manner of races, whatever they may be. He is the Lord of the moon, he is the Lord of the stars, whether you study them in astronomy or astrology. It doesn't matter much because Jesus is the Lord and Master of everything. His power pervades the whole universe. He is the Lord of all. That, I'd remind you, is the reason for our change in the lesson this evening. Because in Jeremiah 23, the passage that Terry read to us, God asks, where do you think you're going to go that I'm not there? For I fill everything. But now we're told in the New Testament that Jesus is the one who is everywhere filling everything. Now you find that in many passages in this epistle to the Ephesians, such as Ephesians chapter 4 verse 10, as in Ephesians 1:10, it speaks of his universal lordship. It is a very strong and striking message, for it means that all the political powers and tyrants of the universe are under his power. Think about the implications of that for our own lives. We have people who want to preach the gospel in China. China doesn't look open to gospel preaching. But the government in China is not outside the control of God, outside the control of Jesus. It is under his control. It may be doing things that are directly opposed to his kingdom, but it is still under his control, and we can still be appealing to God, to Jesus, to alter the political powers of China, to open the doors for the gospel to be preached. That can be done.
For Jesus is not just the God of the Australians, or of the Europeans, or of the Africans, but the Chinese as well, and every part of this world. Think of the absolute implications it involves in terms of comparative religions. For if Jesus is the Lord of the whole universe and of all religions, then indeed he is the one, supreme one, by which men can come to God. There is no other name given amongst men by which we can be saved than the name Jesus, for he is the Lord of all. But if he is the Lord of all, it is especially true that he is the Lord of the church. For if he is the one who rules the universe, the place where his rule is most clearly to be proclaimed is within the congregation of his own people. You may remember his words in Matthew chapter 18. He said, "Wherever two or three gather in my name, there am I in their midst." Jesus' fellowship, Jesus' presence, Jesus' power is especially expressed in the fellowship of Christian people. And so he says to his disciples, to his apostles, when he sends them out in Matthew 28, "Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." For Jesus is with his people, individually and corporately. For Christ fills us with God's presence. He does it through his Spirit, but it is his aim to do. Turn to Ephesians 3:19, the end of the prayer which we're looking at now, really, for he has a two-chapter kind of interlude. He wants us to know the love of God or love of Christ, which surpasses knowledge, so that we may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. Christ's aim is to fill us with the very nature of God. And so, as a church, as individuals, the rule of Christ over the whole universe is especially poured out. We especially are here as an expression of his rule. But in fact, it goes further than that. For if you look at our chapter 1, verse 22, you will see that Jesus died and rose again and has been exalted to this position of power and authority for his church. The reason for which he has gone through that which he lived and died and rose and experienced, the reason he has been raised and exalted, is for us. I was discussing the matter of the resurrection of Jesus in the office the other day, and I suggested that there were two things said in the Bible about the resurrection of Jesus. It says that God raised Jesus from the dead, and it also says that Jesus raised himself from the dead. To which a friend, Gary Speckman, said to me, "But there's a third thing. There's a third way in which Jesus was raised." So I thought back through my Bible again, doing a quick Cruden's Concordance all through the verses in my head, and I couldn't think of any other way in which he was raised other than God raised him. And Jesus raised himself. But Gary reminded me of the verse at the end of Romans 4 which says he was raised for our justification and said that we raised him also. Not in the exercise of our power, but it was because of us that he died and rose again. It is because of us that he has been ascended to the right hand of God. But he did it in order to purchase his own people. Titus 2:14 points that out. That Jesus' whole mission was an aim to gather together a people. That's what he was doing. He was laying down his life and rising again to gather that group together. And the word gather or gathering is the meaning of the word church. I know we use it for lots of other things like this rain shelter or a denomination like the Church of England and all those kind of things. But in the Bible, the word church means a gathering. And what Jesus tries to do in living and dying and rising and ascending to the right hand of God is to gather together his people, to form a great gathering, a great church. And so he is raised for the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who filled all in all. Now what does it mean to say that he's his body? Well, it's a strange phrase and you can take it in lots of ways. It's commonly thought that Jesus, you see, is like a bodiless head and we are like a headless body. Yeah, I got that the right way around. We are like a headless body, you see. And that that what Jesus is a head up in the sky looking for a body to attach to himself. And that he is not complete until he's got his body. And that's why it talks about being the fullness of him. I don't think that's what it's meaning. I take it that the explanation comes in chapter 5 of Ephesians, that we are his bride. For that is what the church is. It is the bride of Christ. And the bride of a husband is his body in Ephesians 5. But we are not a headless body. We don't talk about the head, but you'll find that when he uses the illustration in 1 Corinthians, he talks about the different parts of the body in the church, part of the parts of the head, the tongue, the ears, the eyes. See, the eyes say to the hand, I do not need you. My eyes are in my head. I don't know where you're carrying yours, but I presume that the eyes are part of the function of people here. No, the analogy has got that of a bride and a bridegroom. We are his body in that we are his bride. And he has come to earth to live, to die, to rise again in order to purchase his bride, with whom he is united like a husband and wife is united, so that the two become one, so that a man can talk about his wife as if it is his own body. For she is his body, for the two have become one, as Christ has become one with his church. And so, we are his body. He has come and done all this in order to purchase us. This then, this gathering, this particular gathering of people, is the church of Jesus Christ. This gathering of people is the body of Christ, his bride. This is the very center of his filling with power and affection on earth. And therefore, this gathering is of far greater significance than it appears. The man who comes in who only has the eyes in his head will look and say, it's a gathering. They do funny things, they sing funny songs, they listen to funny speakers and all kinds of other funny things, but it's just a group of people. But the person who understands whom Jesus really is, and that he has come and lived and died and risen and ascended again in order to purchase a gathering, in order to bring about his own special inheritance, then this gathering of people is the bride of the ruler of the universe. And as such, is splendid. Not in their own rights, but in the fact of whom they are, to whom they are married. For it is here that his power and authority reside in particular. For he is our head, our ruler, our Lord, our husband. And we must never replace him with another, with the spirit, or with a local guru, or a far afield guru. He is the one, for he has purchased us. If the gospel is true, that is that Jesus is the Lord of heaven and earth, risen and ascended to that position, then this gathering is the center of the new world order. This is the very expression of what heaven is about. This is where we've come to. And as much as we're in this age, this is the best we can experience of the fellowship of heaven, of the joy of being with God's people forever, as much as we will experience of the transformed life. It is hardly an optional extra for Christians. It's hardly anachronistic, seeing it is for the future age, although you may like to call it anachronistic, seeing it is broken into this age. But it cannot be irrelevant if the gospel is true. Its importance is only derivative from Jesus. Now, of course, coming along to a gathering like this doesn't make a person a Christian. No one's suggesting that for a moment. You only come to gatherings like this out of curiosity, if you're not a Christian or something like that, but you come here regularly and consistently as members because you are Christian, not in order to make you Christian by coming. But if you are Christian, then there is no way in the world that you can be an individualist. Because Christ has died, has risen again, to gain a bride. He has ascended to his position to purchase a body. And that is a corporate expression which involves all his people.